From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. America elected Donald Trump to the White House 1 week ago today. He'll take the oath of office January 20th as the 45th president of the United States. Here's what number 44 has to say about his successor.
We are now all rooting for his success in uniting and leading the country. The peaceful transition of power is one of the hallmarks of our democracy. And over the next few months, we are going to show that to the world.
So much about the underpinnings of our country was exposed during this election year, and we will devote the hour today to what our next steps might be. We'll do that with a look at what we can learn from the 2016 election, what went wrong, if anything, and what should change. First, though, let's return to a conversation we had yesterday. My guest was Ryan Gravel. He was lead designer of the Atlanta Beltline. He recently resigned from the Atlanta Beltline Partnership over concerns about affordability and accessibility.
Because we, from the beginning, had a very inclusive, diverse coalition of people who made the Beltline happen in the first place, we're accountable to everybody, and you know, not just abstract populations of people, but to my friends and neighbors.
Here are your first thoughts. Steve, who goes by The Rain Saver on Twitter, tweets, "Great talk and hopefulness. I do not have a lot of faith in improving the trend of lack of affordable housing." And in terms of congestion on the Beltline pathway, Autumn called with this idea.
I currently live in Midtown, and I grew up in Erie, Pennsylvania, and we have a long bike trail, and the easiest solution to the overcrowding on the Beltline is paint a white line. You'd be amazed how well that works.
We love hearing from you with your simple solutions. You can call us, just like Autumn did, at 404-500-9457. You can also find us on Facebook or tweet us. It's at OST Talk. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. In an election that drew the attention of the world, many voters chose to stay home. Exit polls show Hillary Clinton did not pull anywhere near the same number of Black and Latino voters as Barack Obama did in both 2008 and 2012. And if you pull back for an even broader picture, only 57% of eligible voters in the country cast ballots this year, a little over. That means nearly 100 million eligible citizens did not vote. Why? Goldie Taylor joins us to talk about this. She is editor-at-large for The Daily Beast. Welcome back, Goldie.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Also with us is Savannah State University professor Bob Smith. He joined us before to talk about a course that he teaches on now President-elect Donald Trump. Hi there, Bob.
Hi there. My pleasure to be here.
And also with us again is Emory University professor of political science, Andra Gillespie. Always a pleasure, Andra.
Thank you for having me.
So first, let's talk about the number of non-voters. And it can be confusing because the actual raw number of voters went up. But as a percentage of the population, it went down. Goldie, in an election that raised so many passions and was such an object of, for some people, obsession, why the disinterest in voting, do you think?
Well, I think there were a couple of things at play. While, you know, some passions were certainly riled, some of those passions, I think, in effect, depressed the vote. When you saw people looking at two candidates and saying out loud, "I don't know which one is worse," or "I might have to choose the lesser of two evils." If you look at 2008 and 2012, especially in 2008, voters were coming out in a spirit of hope and a spirit of aspiration. That wasn't true this time, really, of either candidate, and neither was able to truly, you know, I think, inspire anyone to that.
So, Bob, what about President-elect Trump's candidacy, which I imagine is going to change your curriculum, because people are saying that while he won the Electoral College votes, he got fewer votes than Mitt Romney, who many political analysts say was a fairly weak candidate. So why, with Trump pulling in all those thousands of people at rallies, why did he end up doing worse than his predecessor?
Sure. That's I think, in some respects, a $1 million question. Once again, it seems to me that what you're talking about is the way that presidential campaigns are being run these days. It's really all about the focus on the Electoral College and where you need to carry enough margins to be able to secure enough votes. And I think with the focus on that, it's just the overall popular vote, while certainly significant, and again, over history, we can look at the times things where the history of the popular vote has been different from the Electoral College vote. It speaks to the nuances of, I guess, sophisticated campaigns, especially now in the 21st century, where there's a real outreach and sort of almost a micro focus on trying to get out to certain sets of and segments of voters to be able to draw that. As to why Donald Trump overall did not have that popular message across the general electorate, once again, it certainly, is an interesting point that we'll be studying over the next few years or maybe many years, but the math of the Electoral College is what carries the day. And I would have to argue that at some point, perhaps that math may come into question. In other words, the functioning of the Electoral College since the Founding Fathers, not too many mothers, but Founding Fathers put that in place, will be the subject of a lot of analysis.
Well, and we will get to that in a moment. But Andra, I want to get to the issue of the votes of people of color, because now we see a huge number of all people of color, but blacks in particular, protesting Trump's victory, and yet they didn't seem to have turned out in numbers to vote for Hillary Clinton. Why?
Well, there are a number of reasons. So I think overall, the malaise that did affect this entire campaign affected people of color, too. So people were turned off by very polarizing candidates who were engaged in a negative campaign. So that does a good job of driving up base support, but it also can depress other types of people, especially if folks were very, very conflicted. Then we're now hearing these different reports about whether or not campaigns were doing as much GOTV as they could have. And I'm sure the Clinton campaign
GOTV,
right now—
get out the vote.
Get out the vote. And so I'm sure they're thinking woulda, coulda, shoulda in places like Wisconsin and Michigan in particular. But there was also this discussion of Hillary Clinton as a candidate. And with the emergence of Black Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter is trying to figure out a way to be relevant, but also different from their predecessors. And so they've rejected incremental approaches for policy redress. And there were definitely some people who were saying things like, both of these candidates don't represent our interests, so it may be better to not vote at all if you couldn't decide to vote for Gary Johnson or Jill Stein. I think the question that now comes from that, was this the election to use that particular strategic move?
Which I'm sure people will be debating. Goldie, I want take a listen to a former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder. He's speaking here on Bill Maher's Real Time last week.
Okay, so it seems like if one place you can just pop in and vote and the other place there's lines for 6 hours, that would be a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution.
Against the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution and goes against the fundamental thing that binds us as Americans, the ability of the people to decide who their leaders are, who their leaders are going to be, and what policies those leaders will shape.
Goldie, to what extent do you think, I mean, we all saw, Rose, those reports and photos of long, long lines, especially in largely African-American neighborhoods. To what extent do you think that affected this election?
Well, I think there was a tremendous impact, specifically in places like North Carolina, where there was a purging, of voters from the rolls. I think there was a court order at the last minute to have those people re-added, but that kind of conflict and confusion certainly leads to a fair level of suppression. And so we find that really throughout the country. I tend to side with former Attorney General Holder when he talks about, how voting disparities in different places tends to fall against the Equal Protection Clause. But I don't fall on the side of federalizing elections, but I do fall on the side of federalizing the rules. Because I think that there are some states, and we're going to find a bit more of this, I think, now that you've got a unified governing party controlling, really all three branches of government, I think you're going to find even more measures taken to make certain that constituencies that don't necessarily support them come election day aren't able to get to the ballot box. And so I think you're going to see more of that. And as that comes, I think there are going to have to be activists on the ground, including some of those that we saw in these last several days, including people like now former Attorney General Eric Holder, who really stand to hold people to account to keep that ballot box open to every, eligible American citizen.
This is a really good question, though, Bob, and let me put it to both you and Andra, because this was our first presidential election since the enforcement clause of the Voting Rights Act was struck down. Let's listen to Eric Holder one more time. Again, he's on Real Time with Bill Maher.
There's always been an element in our voting system that you had to prove who you were, but they've only come up recently with this notion of these more restrictive and prescriptive things that have a negative impact on those people who are less likely to vote for Republicans. And they also happen to affect disproportionately people of color.
Bob, to what extent is this now a subject for study?
Oh, it certainly has been, and I think it certainly will be, perhaps even with more vigor at this point, because, again, the mechanics of ballot access are absolutely crucial and imperative to the foundation of democracy, and again, particularly how that affects a variety of segments of our population, whether that's African Americans, whether that's Latinos. The idea is that that will, again, be sort of a renewed focus in terms of trying to understand, again, looking at what happened in this past election, but again, maybe projecting ahead into future elections.
Andra, I want to make sure that we get to another question many voters have had, and I saw this rephrased a number of times, which is, will we ever get back to civil elections and civil politics? Let's listen to President Obama. This is him actually speaking at the Democratic National Convention over the summer.
Every shade of humanity forged into common service. That's why anyone who threatens our values, whether fascists or communists or jihadists or homegrown demagogues, will always fail in the end.
So this was a very rancorous and ugly campaign. Is this the new norm?
I would say in the short term, this is probably not going to change. I don't think that we've hit rock bottom yet, sadly. I am hopeful that we can change and get to a different point. What I think it's going to take is a wake-up call. And I also think that it's going to take the winners in particular not abiding by some of the more rancorous aspects of the campaign. So I think, honestly, it's going to take people from the right standing up to their party and telling them that this is completely unacceptable behavior. And I think people are going to have to make some choices about perhaps being willing to lose an election or two in order to take the stand that these are not the kinds of candidates that we should be cultivating.
They have not usually made that choice.
And they haven't made that choice yet. And so because they haven't made that choice yet, I think, people are privileging winning above all else without realizing the cost that comes on the other side of it. So I think we're probably in for another rough couple of years.
Bob, in the 2 minutes that we have left, was the amount of insults and rancor and sort of ugliness, was it unprecedented, or is this something we've seen before in history?
Sure. I think, again, a great question, because I think with the sort of the newness of the election results and the rancor of this particular campaign, I mean, I think we tend to lose sight of previous campaigns. And I think, you know, the world of politics, particularly presidential politics and the presidential campaign, has always been sort of rough and tumble. And I think that there has certainly been, sort of these types of heated exchanges in the past. But I would say, though, not to this particular level. And so, again, this call for a return to civility in the political process is, as suggested, is something that's crucial.
Goldie, we have 30 seconds left. Did you want to weigh in on who can bring us back to civility?
You know, well, I think there certainly will be a call to civility, although I'm a bit more cynical about whether or not we'll arrive at it. You know, when we asked Donald Trump after this election, did he regret some of the things said and done? He said, no, I won. And I think that really is, you know, sort of the prevailing thought for so many these days, that we are winning at every cost. And I think that the line has been moved in a permanent way, but how far it's been moved is yet to be seen.
That is Daily Beast editor Goldie Taylor, Emory professor Andra Gillespie. They'll stick around with us a bit longer. And Savannah State University professor Bob Smith, it's good to talk to you as well. Thanks to all three of you. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This whole hour, we focus on what may change after this election. One change we hope is temporary is the rise in racist incidents since Trump's win. But what role did women and minorities actually play in this campaign, and what might change going forward? Still with us is Goldie Taylor. She's an editor-at-large with The Daily Beast. Hi there, Goldie.
Hello. Good morning.
Also with us by Skype is journalist and documentary filmmaker Jose Antonio Vargas. By phone, Jose, hi there.
Hi, how are you?
And Adrian White of the Center for Civil and Human Rights right here in Atlanta joins me as well. Hi, Adrian.
Hi, good morning.
So, Jose, there is a lot of recriminations going around now, and then backlash as well as to what a vote for Trump or against Trump meant. How are we to take Trump's win when many of the things that he said were anti-Muslim, for example, were insulting to Mexicans, were in some ways very marginalizing to African Americans. What then does a Trump vote for him mean?
I think, you know, I think for many people it means different things. You know, for the past 5 years now, I've been traveling nonstop just around the country doing the work that I do. We actually made a documentary for MTV called White People that I ended up producing and directing last summer. And actually, after making that film, I've been telling my friends, I was a political reporter for the Washington Post, I've been telling my reporter friends, my colleagues, my friends, just, hey, I think Trump may win this thing. And I just remember all of my friends telling me that I was crazy. And then I started thinking, man, this is how big the division is in this country, right? Like, you know, I was going to predominantly white communities that are experiencing a lot of changes, right? With a lot of white working class people losing their jobs, manufacturing plants closing, can't send their kids to school. And I think what we really see here is not only a class divide and not only a race divide, but a culture divide, right? Like a cultural divide. And I think for us in the immigrant community, right? Like right now, I mean, I would be understating it if I didn't tell you that what's happening right now is just pure panic, right? Like he has said that he's going to be deporting 2 to 3 million people. And when you say 2 to 3 million people, it's not just those people, it's the family members of all those people. So the fact that this is the reality that we're all dealing with, I don't really have time, to be perfectly honest with you, nor the energy to decipher how we got to where we got. I just want to understand what we are all going to do together now. Stand with each other. Like, when they say something anti-Muslim, anti-black, anti-women, like, how are we in the immigrant community going to stand up for women and Muslims and black people so that we actually are in solidarity with each other?
Okay, so, Adrian, let me play you this clip, and it has been shared a number of times. This is CNN political commentator Van Jones talking about why he felt Donald Trump won.
But it was also something else. This was a white lash against a changing country. It was a white lash against a black president in part. And that's the part where the pain comes. And Donald Trump has a responsibility tonight to come out and reassure people that he is going to be the president of all the people who he insulted and offended and brushed aside.
So, Adrian, how are we to take this in? Because President Obama also has very high approval ratings for a president. So how can we have Obama having very high approval ratings and at the same time Van Jones saying that Trump's election was a white lash against Obama?
It really blows my mind. I mean, I think it's more complex than just a white lash. You definitely have a segment of the population who is tired of minorities getting access to things such as the presidency. But then I also think you've got people who are suffering, like Jose had mentioned. People don't have jobs in certain places. And so I think there are some people who may have voted for Trump, even though people like Obama as a person. They think he's cool. He's got mad swagger. You know, you want to hang out with him and have a beer. But I think people can separate that from their personal pain. And so maybe that explains why you've got a high percentage of people saying they like Obama, yet and still we have this monster who's now our president-elect.
Okay, so Goldie, as we try to grapple with what role race and gender both played in the election and may play going forward, let's take a listen to Donald Trump. Here he is speaking on Fox News. They asked him about the term Black Lives Matter.
Well, first of all, I think the term is very divisive. The first time I heard it, I said, you have to be kidding. It can't be used that. They just can't. I think it's a very, very, very divisive term. There's no question about it.
What role did the rise of the Black Lives Matter play then, do you think, Goldie?
Well, you know, I think that the outcome of this election and the reasons for the causal relationship here is multi-layered. And I do believe that the uprisings, the more prominent media coverage of the Black Lives Matter movement did fuel a bit of a what my colleague Van Jones calls a white lash that people thought or felt like they were losing control of their country. And so on the one hand, while there is major pockets of economic anxiety in this country, some of it is driven by a belief that non-whites are given more opportunity, more avenues, more leeway, that there is little in the way of equal protection for them, that there is, and I think that, you know, my other colleague, Cornell Belcher, raised the point in his latest book that there is, seems to be a rise, well, there is a measurable rise in both implicit and explicit bias against, you know, non-white Americans. And so I don't think you can dismiss the role that, that racial and cultural divisions had on this race, such as, you know, you can't dismiss, you know, the role that economic anxiety may have played in this race. I think it's multi-layered. And I think that, you know, watching some of the things unfold on our television sets over these last, you know, several years, I think that there is a narrative out there of black criminality, of inherently immoral people doing immoral things on our nation's streets and are allowed to get away with it. And maybe they're funded by Soros. I think those kinds of things inform an electorate in very dangerous ways.
We got a tweet from journalist Kathy Lohr who says, how are we to achieve civility as this is going on? And then she tweeted a link to a report showing that hate crimes against Muslims were up 67%. Last year. So let's then bring women into this. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the role that race and gender may have played in election 2016 and when, what role it may play going forward. You can tweet us your responses at OST Talk. My guests are Goldie Taylor of The Daily Beast, journalist and filmmaker Jose Antonio Vargas, and Adrian White of the Center for Civil and Human Rights. And let's bring women in, shall we? Here
Please.
Is the second presidential debate. CNN's Anderson Cooper is pressing Donald Trump about comments that he made in terms of kissing women and groping them. Trump defended himself and said it was locker room talk.
I have great respect for women. Nobody has more respect for women than I do.
So for the record, you're saying you never did that.
I said things that, frankly, you hear these things I said, and I was embarrassed by it, but I have tremendous respect for women.
Have you ever done those things?
And women have respect for me, and I will tell you, no, I have not.
Okay, so Adrian, Donald Trump attracted a huge number of especially votes of white women. Why?
I've been wrestling with this, and, you know, as I observe various conversations, I think white women may not understand their level of oppression, and that may be a blind spot for them because it's like, I'm white, I can do whatever I want. But and they don't even recognize you're not making the same amount as of pay as the man that's working right next to you doing the same job. So I think there's this lack of consciousness around the level of oppression that they're experiencing such that they can look at Trump and excuse some of his just vile, nasty comments against women.
Although, Jose, some say, look, that may be campaign talk, or that may be what he said before he was a candidate. But I think many people feel as though that's not the way he will be as president. What's your response to that?
Well, I mean, I think this is the new, you know, I've been at airports a lot, and I've been looking at all the magazines with Trump in it, on the cover, and he's in the cover of People magazine this week. And I'm just thinking about how we've normalized this man. Mm-hmm. Like, we're talking about a reality television star. We're talking about a guy that, unlike anybody else in American politics, certainly in the American presidency, has come from us in kind of the pop culture vein, right? Like, people feel like, I was actually surprised at how my own family members talk about Trump. Like, they know him or something, because they've been watching Apprentice all these years. And I'm like, catching them say these things, and I'm like, wait a second. Like, this guy is the president now. So I think with him, there's just been this level
and
of...
And achieved over 60 million votes.
And over 60 million votes. I mean, this is really the... Let us remember that... The same news media, right? I mean, Jeff Zucker, who runs CNN now, right, was head of NBC, right? And allowed Trump for months and months on CNN to just talk uninterrupted, right, in those rallies and in those speeches. I mean, I think we've normalized his behavior, right? And I think for me, actually, that's what I find one of the most troubling things in this entire kind of episode.
So, Goldie, let me push back just a little bit, and let me play you this comment from Scotty Neil Hughes, often was on cable news during the run-up to the election. Here she is explaining why she decided to vote for Trump. These are just a mashup of a few of her comments from CNN.
There are plenty of women that are supporting Donald Trump for one reason only, because he's not Hillary Clinton.
If there's any moral obligations to make sure that Hillary Clinton does not get in the White House.
In fact, if Hillary Clinton would have been honest at the time, maybe we would not have had a 19-year-old in the Oval Office in a blue dress and a cigar. The key about all this is, yes, Donald Trump may be vulgar, but Hillary Clinton is a two-faced liar.
And perhaps in terms of our discussions on gender, perhaps for a large number of women in the United States, vulgar comments are not as important or not their high priority.
You know, I tend to take Donald Trump at his word, and I find some of Scotty Neil Hughes's most prominent remarks unfortunate. You know, I think that I when I say I take Donald Trump at his word, I don't know that what he said on that bus was necessarily locker room talk when you see so many women coming forward to saying, yes, that is exactly what he did to me. And so I don't know that this apple is rolling very far away from its verbal tree. And so I think that that is something that women voters did not contend with, maybe because of the onslaught of information that we saw during this campaign, that we couldn't stay on one subject more than, you know, maybe 8 to 12 hours before we were moved on to something else, some other thing. And I think there came a point where there was so much controversy and so much scandal that we tended to turn a tin ear. But I think on top of that, there's one more thing around all of this, and I think that Jose and some others have touched on it. There is a growing distrust for American media, whether, and we get most of our news on social media and Facebook and other places, but in terms of broadcasting cable news, in terms of mainstream media outlets like the Washington Post and the New York Times and the LA Times, those are less believable than, you know, what you might find on a Facebook page put up by, you know, some anonymous person.
We are going to dig into that deeply in just a few minutes, but let me play one more comment. And Jose, the question for me is, Donald Trump is our legitimately elected president-elect in the United States. Half of eligible voters, those who went to the polls, are very happy to see that happen. And so the question becomes, for those people of color who may be upset and afraid, how do we move forward as a united nation? Here is Dave Chappelle. When he hosted Saturday Night Live last weekend.
I saw how happy everybody was. These people who had been historically disenfranchised. And it made me feel proud to be an American, and it made me very happy about the prospects of our country. In that spirit, I'm wishing Donald Trump luck, and I'm going to give him a chance. And we, the historically disenfranchised, demand that he give us one too.
The first instance he's describing is when Barack Obama was elected. So how does race and gender move forward in terms of protecting the rights of all Americans, as Donald Trump has said he wants to do? Jose?
How do we all move forward given this? Right after, I think it was maybe, 4 days ago, I went to Dearborn, Michigan, which is the largest concentration of Arab Americans in this country. And the reason I did that, you know, there was an ACLU event, and the reason I did that is because I wanted to say as an undocumented immigrant that, you know, to the Muslim community, that we have your back, and I hope that you have ours too, right? There was a comment that Donald Trump has made about appointing justices that would overturn Roe versus Wade. Like, this now, as I said a few minutes ago, is a real test of what solidarity really looks like for all of us who don't have the luxury of just laughing this off or saying that let's give this a try, right? Like, he has talked about certain things that's going to happen in the next few, in the first few days of his presidency, maybe deporting immigrants or banning Muslims, that is going to put a real test on how we're going to stand up and speak out for each other. And that is something that I'm trying to work on now to try to figure out, you know, what that's going to look like for us.
So, Adrian, in the minute that we have left, how to explain the fear of many people to those who feel like Donald Trump really is going to be a great president?
So it's kind of like if you have a child and you're babysitting your neighbor's friend and another child comes and beats that child up and you just don't understand why they're beating them up and you just sit to the side, like the other parent's childs are just, why did you do this? I can't trust you. I'll never send my child over to you again. And so throughout the course of this entire campaign, Trump has said, he has said things constantly against Muslims, women, just any minority that can exist. And I take that as a promise. Like when you are campaigning, you are making promises to the American people. And at this point, I don't want any of those promises to materialize. And I beg of the people that voted for him, just be patient and be sympathetic and understand we fear this.
Adrian White of the Center for Civil and Human Rights, also journalist and filmmaker Jose Antonio Vargas. Thanks so much to both of you. Goldie Taylor of the Daily Beast sticks around. We will continue to talk about election 2016. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. We continue our hour of coverage, not necessarily of the campaign, but looking forward, what may change. Many people, including Donald Trump, had some very harsh things to say about media coverage over the past 2 years. Not only did the pollsters get it wrong, but there have been other questions about ethics and choices in coverage. We're joined now by New York Times columnist Jim Rutenberg to consider this with us. He joins us. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. Daily Beast editor-at-large Goldie Taylor is still with us. Been very outspoken in her scrutiny of mainstream news this year, as we heard earlier. Hi again, Goldie.
Good morning.
And Andra Gillespie returns. She's a professor of politics, a professor of political science, at Emory University. Hello again, Andra.
Hello.
Okay, so let's begin with the million-dollar question. Let me go to you first, Jim, because, look, I'm reading a headline from Fortune magazine that says, here is proof that the media helped create Donald Trump. To what extent did the media choose sides, do you think?
I don't know what choosing side. I mean, clearly, almost every major editorial board endorsed Hillary Clinton. So that's clear. A lot of conservative opinion writers were kind of in the Never Trump camp.
Including David Brooks of the New York Times, yeah.
And it certainly carried over. That said, there was also, and I've been talking about this a lot, a way that Donald Trump had to be covered because of some of his behavior, some of his proposals, his refusal to release his own taxes, some of the tapes that came out later that actually really called for a kind of scrutiny we hadn't seen before that he clearly felt was a pile-on. His supporters did. A lot of that reporting had to happen.
Okay, so Andra, then yesterday I spoke with former AJC reporter and editor Bill Shipp. He has a long history. He broke the news about Jimmy Carter's run for president, has covered a number of presidents. Shipp describes Donald Trump as a demagogue. That's his opinion. But he says he is one among those who says the media is partially to blame for his popularity.
Well, the media made Donald Trump by every time Trump would utter anything, they'd call him or get him on TV, and he was happy to oblige. He must have gotten several billion dollars worth of TV. It's not unusual to have a demagogue attack the press as one of their main villains.
Okay, so leaving behind actually what's happened, looking forward, does something need to change, do you think, in media's choice of coverage during presidential campaigns?
I think there are a number of things that I would recommend that the media do differently this time. One, there should probably be more reporting from middle America. You know, people just need to remember that there are lots of people in this country who are probably not like them and don't have the same experience. And you want to make sure that you give a voice to all of those concerns so that people feel like they're being represented. The issue of allowing Donald Trump to do phone interviews, I think is something that will probably be revisited in the future, because he helped to set the terms and the tone by which he would be scrutinized. And people allowed it because it allowed for great accessibility to him, but it also in many instances gave him a platform and to not be challenged as well. And, you know, I am not running for president. I don't claim to be famous, but every time I suggest to TV stations that I call in because I'm out of town, like, they never take me up on it. And so I have taken that as kind of, you know, as a signal that, you know, if it's not live, then it's not really worth it. And they should apply that same type of standard to presidential candidates. I think the other thing that will have to be revisited, especially for cable news, is the balance between analysis versus surrogacy.
The use of pundits.
Not just pundits. Pundits who are analysts are fine. But I think the notion of having surrogates duke it out.
Somebody who's working for the campaign.
Who's working for the campaign, who, you know, who's clearly, you know, a supporter and identified as a supporter of the campaign. When they're allowed to sit and argue on television for ratings,
yeah.
I think that coarsens our discourse.
So, Goldie, let's go to Andra's point about not covering middle America, because I think it's fair to say that, in part, many of the people who voted for Donald Trump and liked Donald Trump, part of their passion came from a feeling that they were unheard, that their needs were not addressed. Let's take a listen here to a commentator on MSNBC.
To me, the biggest miss of all had to do with the public polling that we were seeing in states like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, which after the James Comey big bombshell announcement still had Hillary Clinton up 4 or 5 points in Pennsylvania. Even her numbers had been in double digits in the Keystone State. And then importantly, that big poll out of Wisconsin that had her up 6 points. And that gave us an indication that that blue wall was still held up.
So he's talking about the inaccuracy of polls, but to a certain extent, he's also talking about the unheard voices from middle America. Goldie?
Well, he does make two arguments there. The first around polling is this, and people like Nate Silvel and others will tell you that in public polling, only 10% of people actually are become respondents or agree to participate in polling. And so that sort of narrows down. And I think that depression in number comes from people who distrust polls for one reason or another. You saw Donald Trump playing into that narrative that you can't trust these corrupt polls out there put out by corrupt media. And so there really is a distance or space growing between what's happening in middle America and how they're reflected in popular media and even how they're reflected in popular polling. And so it was a miss on any number of counts by any number of news organizations and pollsters. But I think we've got to decide as a media industry, and there's so many different types of us now that citizen journalism really has been mainstreamed in so many ways. We've got to decide who we are. We've got to decide
as journalists,
we've got to decide who we are. We've got to decide that we really do have standards and practices by which to adhere. While people like the New York Times and Washington Post did a much better job at prosecuting the issues during this campaign cycle, when you look at cable news and putting together and I was a part of that world for a very long time, putting together a newscast based on the pyrotechnics of it all rather than on the salient analysis of it all, then I think we really run into an awful lot of problems. And
yeah.
I think that causes a disruption in the trust factor between audiences, you know, in the media that they consume.
So, and I think Goldie, just to your point, I think there are a number of interesting things there. First, one of the reasons why I say we need to go to middle America was that apparently journalists in the heartland were noticing things where they were seeing Trump signs in places where you would normally not see Republican mm-hmm. signs.
Absolutely.
And those signs were being missed by those of us who were on the coast. And it affected our polling because we undersampled people in rural areas.
Yeah.
Like, the polls actually weren't garbage. The problem is that we misinterpret polls. Those polls were technically within the margin of error. All of them were. But we truncate our margins of error, and because we truncate our margins of error, we read them incorrectly.
And it was odd because Hillary Clinton ended up winning the popular vote. Let me, in terms of polling. So let's now listen to another TV clip that has been watched a number of times. This is John Oliver from his show Last Week Tonight. And Jim, I want to throw this to you because he's talking about why the New York Times is not really trusted anymore. He's talking about fake news and news on social media.
But there is now a whole cottage industry specializing in hyper-partisan, sometimes wildly distorted clickbait. BuzzFeed News researched sites like Addicting Info on the left and Freedom Daily on the right, both of which have over a million followers on Facebook, putting them in the same range as Anderson Cooper 360, and found that some of them were publishing many viral articles containing flat-out falsehoods.
Over 2 weeks, 38% of news on some Republican-leaning Facebook pages was partly or completely false, compared to 19% of news shared on some Democrat-leaning Facebook pages.
Jim, I mean, I understand all the criticism of the media, and there's a lot of it coming from both sides. But when papers and organizations like ours invest in reporting, but it's not believed, what are we to do?
Well, first of all, Facebook has been less than ideal in the way it's handled this over the last few days. There's been a lot of denial mixed with some what seem to be, but I think are probably better than, half-hearted vows to kind of get to the bottom of this. But it does show the value of reporting, and I don't know, because the news media has had a campaign run against it, not just during this year, but for decades now. It takes a toll. We are not politicians. We are journalists. And so all we can do is keep doing really ambitious, aggressive reporting. We have to be aware, for instance, that some part of the country will see that sometimes as going after their person, just as there were complaints that the press wasn't hard enough on Obama from many of these Trump voters. And I think that's where the antidote is what we're talking about, which is covering the people everywhere, getting a real understanding of everybody's views. But all we can do is keep to our knitting and really attack the fake news when it comes out, shine a light on it to debunk it.
We got a tweet from Roy Lee who says, the liberals lost when they labeled all Trump supporters as bigots and racists, liberal ignorance at its best. And let me put that to you, Goldie, because there was a lot of discussion among news outlets on whether to call things racist, whether to call Donald Trump racist. Some news outlets decided, objectively speaking, that he was, and that's what they were going to call him. Some said that's not a journalist's role to put labels on things. What do you think about that?
Well, as journalists, we do put labels on things. We do define things. We're a part of a discourse that decides what is what. And if we can't call a ball and a strike, then maybe we're not in the right business. I think, as you know, my dear friend, the late Gwen Ifill, said so eloquently that, and I guess I have to paraphrase her because I'm not nearly as eloquent as Gwen Ifill, is that, you know, when we stop calling things as they are, then our own credibility truly does suffer. I saw over the last couple of days that Steve Bannon was named as the sort of chief advisor, chief strategist in the new Trump White House. How some news outlets decided to call him controversial, how some decided to say that he was, that his critics found him controversial. Everyone knows and has seen evidence of, from Steve Bannon's own mouth and from the publication that he runs.
Steve Bannon, the publisher of Breitbart and top campaign advisor for Donald Trump. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. We've seen the evidence through and through about anti-Semitic language and behaviors and anti-Muslim behaviors and anti-Black behaviors. He has a segment on his site called the Black Crime segment on his website. And so I think those things have to be sort of called for what they are. And when we fail to do that, I think it speaks to who we are and what we're really trying to accomplish. I think we are hoping not to alienate people by labeling things as they are, that maybe this seems too harsh. I remember we couldn't say the word lie in the middle of a campaign. You couldn't use the word liar. You couldn't call your opponent a liar. You can do that now. But if something is racist, if something is anti-Semitic, if something is misogynist, we should say it. And not saying it calls our credibility into question.
We got a tweet from Sam Burnham who says, the pollsters, news media, Clinton campaign, celebrities all underestimated rural America, no doubt. So, Jim, what needs to change, do you think, in terms of media coverage? We're, at this point, we don't seem to be making anybody happy, including ourselves. What needs to change?
Well, that tweet is categorically true. I think it goes to, I'll pick up where we're leaving off, and that's, you know, we do have to call out racist, misogynistic, anti-Semitic rhetoric. But at the same time, it wouldn't seem as if we're painting everybody with the same brush if we're doing a better job of getting out into, and I'm not saying, this is Long Island, this is Queens and Brooklyn and parts of Philadelphia, so I don't think we should just categorize it as all middle America. I mean, this, it's a state of mind, as Trump voters are everywhere. And I think it's really getting our finger on that pulse. That is so critical as he puts together an administration, starts pursuing his programs and agenda. And so it's pretty basic, but it's finding compelling stories about that, his supporters, and how they feel like this thing is going, what their lives are like, how much he can really do. It's pretty basic.
Andre, you wanted to, I see you wanting to weigh in here.
And I think another important thing that we haven't thought about that even starts before we get to the media is, one, getting people to define terms the same way. Because the whole issue and controversy about racism is that we don't agree about what racism is. But it's also civics education, and it's also evidentiary education. It's teaching people how government is supposed to work and why and what the background is and the context for it. But it's also teaching people how to take evidence and to be able to assimilate it. I think the thing that's shocking about fake news is that in many different instances, there is something in that news article that should not pass the smell test, that should actually warrant deeper investigation. But people just take it at face value. And we've got to teach people to be critical and to be skeptical, and then also how to do their homework to make sure that what they're taking in is real.
So we have only about 2 minutes left, and I hate to do this to you, Goldie, but there is an aversion to facts and evidence. There's a resistance to accepting just facts. And to what extent are we responsible for that by turning everything into a debate, by using false equivalents and making everything have one side and another side?
I think that is exactly right. I think this, what I call both-siderism, has really done us a disservice, you know, really as journalists writ large, that this false equivalency has cost us in really significant ways. And it's showing up now in the electric, not that they had any great trust for us before. I mean, we were right down there around used car salesmen. But it is falling precipitously. And some candidates, some people in popular media have figured out a way to harness that dropping to their own gain. I think Donald Trump was a near expert at this during this campaign cycle. And so I think, you know, our other two guests are absolutely right about getting to the heart of what's happening in middle America and watching and seeing their lives reflected in popular media is, I think, an important thing. I think I'm all for more voices, but not fewer. But when we hear certain things come again and again from a political candidate and we stand down, then I think some of the blame is really on our hands.
This whole hour we've been focused on the fallout of election 2016. I want to say thank you to Daily Beast editor-at-large Goldie Taylor, New York Times columnist Jim Rutenberg, and political scientist Andre Gillespie. Thanks so much to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Obviously,
so much.
There's much more to be said and will be said during the next 4 years of Donald Trump's presidency. But as always, we want to hear from you as well. Do you think anything will change or should change because of this election? What change would you bring about if you could? Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Facebook, or you can find us on Twitter. The show is at OSD Talk, and I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.